Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Angel Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We'll talk about what I'm reading about. And we are going to break down some Arctic cows. But before we get in today's episode, I'm going to tell you there's a new thing coming at now, actually, this week. We're going to start doing it. And then I'm going to carry it out probably until the end of 2020-ish. See how everyone responds to it and then go from there. And that thing is, I'm going to start releasing at least two, maybe three podcasts during the week, maybe on a Tuesday, Thursday, or Wednesday, Friday, and it's just going to be one article. It's going to be one article that I break down in a little bit more depth than I break down other articles. I'm going to maybe get into some of the statistical analysis behind the article, why I think the article doesn't work for my practice or what I'm seeing, what I think is wrong with the article, or maybe even what is right with the article. But it's going to be a little bit more in depth than the normal Question Medicine. One article might take me, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 minutes to really break down and cover all of the details. I thought about going forward from now on or in 2021, making Questioning Medicine an everyday thing. Every single day, I would just post one podcast online and that would be it. But then I talked to some people and they said, well, I kind of like the 20-minute-ish podcast length. That works well for me. So I don't want to see you go to just a every single day, 6, 7 minute one. That would not work well for me. So we're going to try this where I'm going to continue to release the weekly podcasts, usually every Sunday or Monday, and then do a during the week podcast with just one article, either on Tuesday, Thursday, or Wednesday and Friday. And if this works, and if it works well, and I see that the downloads are coming in and that you happen to enjoy it, and if you do enjoy it, please email me, AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, @gmail.com, and I would love your response, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. You know, this is something I've really mulled over and thought about ad nauseum over the last little bit, and I would love your feedback, whether you do or don't like it. Either way is A-okay with me. And with that being said, enough with the rambling. Let's get on to the show. So without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right. We have so many articles to get to and so little time, so let's jump into the first one, shall we? It is titled Pharmacological Approaches to Glycemic Treatment of Type 2 Diabetes, Synopsis of the 2020 American Diabetes Association Standards of Medical Care in Diabetes Clinical Guideline. Whew. Now, as it suggests in the title, this article is a synopsis of the 2020 American Diabetes Guidelines. I think this is a good place to start because guidelines are one of those things that will get you to where you're going. They just may not get you there the best way. It's kind of like using Google Maps and Waze is the way I like to think about it. Google Maps will always get you to where you're going, but Waze will probably get you there faster. And if you know the real evidence, if you know the papers and the trials, you know the inclusion, exclusion criteria of all the studies for the particular topic that you're looking at, well then I would say that's like using Waze. That is the best form to do. But if you don't know it, if it's something that you're just kind of like, I sort of treat that every now and then, guidelines won't steer you wrong. Guidelines will get you to where you're going. They may not be the best. It may have a number needed to treat that is slightly lower, or number needed a harm that's lower than we would typically do if we knew the evidence inside and out, but they're not going to do harm, which is a key thing in medicine. So in these guidelines, in the synopsis of the guideline, what does it say? Well, it says that metformin is still universally first line, but what do you add to metformin? That is the million-dollar question with a billion-dollar answer, probably literally a billion-dollar answer. And they say that the additional agent added to metformin therapy should be individualized on the basis of patient characteristics, performance, and drug-specific effects. Oh, yes. Among patients with type 2 diabetes who have established ASCVD risk or established chronic kidney disease or heart failure, an SGLT2 inhibitor or GLP-1 receptor agonist with demonstrated cardiovascular disease benefit is recommended, and this is a grade A recommendation. They go on to say that maybe one of the key lines in this whole paper is the addition of these medications, SGLT2 and the GLP-1, should be considered independent from hemoglobin A1C levels in this patient population. And there you have it. You start with metformin, and then you add these other medications based on their risk factors. And just because they do or don't have diabetes, it shouldn't limit you or it shouldn't prevent you from prescribing these medications. Because as we have seen, these medications work whether you have or don't have diabetes, which will take me into one of the next articles, because you might remember dapagliflozin. Dapagliflozin was one of the drugs in one of the articles that last year I said was one of the top articles of the year because it changed how we practice medicine, both for diabetes and for heart failure. Well, now I give you a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Cardiovascular and Renal Outcomes with Empagliflozin in heart failure. Listen closely because I think that this is going to be one of the top papers of 2020. It's the EMPEROR Reduced Trial, which recently came out, and it looked at the use of empagliflozin for the risk reduction in heart failure. Is it possible that empagliflozin could join the ranks with dapagliflozin? Could these two drugs be brother and sister, or sister and sister, or brother and brother, however you want to? Could they be twins? Well, in this double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial, they use empagliflozin 10 milligrams daily. And at a mean follow-up of 16 months, patients receiving empagliflozin had a lower risk for the primary endpoint of cardiovascular death or hospitalization for worsening heart failure compared to placebo. The number needed to treat was 20. Yes, a number needed to treat of 20 to prevent cardiovascular death or hospitalization from worsening heart failure. And although this sounds super impressive, and it is, this outcome was mainly driven by heart failure hospitalizations. There was really not a huge reduction in death, but still, a reduction in heart failure hospitalizations is a good thing. And this reduction in heart failure hospitalization was independent of diabetic diagnosis. It did not matter if the person had diabetes or did not have diabetes. And when you look at the change in the A1C at the end of the trial, there was no difference between those individuals that had empagliflozin and those individuals that got placebo. There was no difference in the A1C. So just maybe, these SGLT2 inhibitors really are people drugs and not diabetic drugs. And everyone, I mean everyone, who looks at this study or looks at any of the studies that are coming out that are showing the hard outcomes, the benefit to the hard outcomes that we all care about, should question the relevance of the surrogate marker that we use for diabetes, the A1C. I don't want to go on too much of a rant, but if we look at the A1C and say, this is the standard by which all drugs should be measured, and some drugs don't change this standard, they don't change the A1C, but they do change the things we care about, like death, hospitalizations, myocardial infarctions. When other drugs are changing the A1C, they're lowering the A1C, but they aren't changing the things that we care about, death, myocardial infarctions, hospitalizations. Just maybe, this A1C doesn't really correlate with death, myocardial infarctions, hospitalizations, because if it did, you would expect that when there is no change in the A1C, then there would be no change to death, myocardial infarctions, hospitalizations. But that's not what we're seeing here. So something else is going on, and we should all be questioning whether A1C is really what we should all be measuring or caring so much about. Now, as excited as I am about the SGLT2 inhibitors just in general, as excited as I am about the fact that they are changing medicine, the fact that they are changing diabetes care, heart failure care, just they're changing care, realistically, the best medication for diabetes and heart failure is still a healthy lifestyle, diet, and exercise, mainly exercise. These drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors, are still around $500 a month. So we're talking at least $6,000 a year for a drug that 95 out of 100 people will never see benefit from. Remember, the number needed to treat was 20. That means out of every 20 people, one person had benefit, 19 people took that drug and saw no benefit to their life. They didn't even see a change in their A1C, statistically speaking, when you looked at the whole population as a whole. So that means out of 100 people, 95 people took the drug and didn't see benefit, but 5 people got benefit. If you translate that into a cost analysis, that means that roughly we are spending $120,000 per event saved. And remember, the main event being saved here was heart failure hospitalizations. So I grant you, this is really impressive. I grant you, dapagliflozin and now empagliflozin really are changing how we practice medicine, and they are preventing heart failure hospitalizations. And I grant you that SGLT2 inhibitors are quickly becoming the king of the castle, the king of the castle for high-risk diabetes treatment. But they will never truly take the throne. They will never truly take over metformin until they're only $4 a month, like metformin. And with that, let's move on to the next article, which is titled Synopsis of the 2020 U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, U.S. Department of DOD Clinical Practice Guideline, the Diagnosis and Management of Hypertension in the Primary Care Setting. Whew, that was another tongue twister, but this is also in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and it had a couple of interesting points on what this guideline said on as far as managing blood pressure. First of all, as I said back in 2019, a couple meta-analyses out that I said should be worked into all clinical guidelines going forward, and that is that if you are in clinical practice, you should be using a fully automated blood pressure measurement. Yes, now the VA and DOD guidelines, they specifically say in their guidelines, a fully automated blood pressure program to wait 5 minutes and record the average of three measurements separated by at least 30 seconds should be used. Their goal blood pressure is less than 130 unless you are 60 years old or older, then it's less than 150. But if you are 60 years old and older and have diabetes, then it's less than 140. Treat these individuals with any of the major drugs, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, calcium channel blockers, thiazides. They don't specify what drug should be used in any certain circumstance. Just use whatever drug you want to use or whatever drug is on formulary. And if someone's on three or more medications, then this is resistant hypertension and you need to give them spironolactone, my friends. Spironolactone is the next step in the management of this patient. Ultimately, there is really nothing too shocking in this guideline or paper that really sticks out other than making sure you're using the automated blood pressure cuff in your clinic. This is now in the guidelines. This should now be standard of care everywhere, and it's certainly something to keep in mind. And speaking of keeping in mind, this next article is titled Enhanced Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction in Episodic Migraine, a Randomized Clinical Trial with MRI Imaging Outcomes. This was in Pain 2020, and in this randomized control trial of almost 100 people recruited, mostly white women who on average were having 8 headaches a month, and 85% were not on any prophylactic medication. The patients were randomized to either a mindfulness-based stress reduction class or stress management headache classes. Both of them are taking classes. Both of them are just taking different classes. Now, the classes met weekly for 8 weeks and then bi-weekly for another 8 weeks. Those in the mindfulness class went from 8 headaches a month down to 5 headaches a month, and those in the stress management class went from 8 headaches a month down to 7 headaches a month. So there was a much bigger difference in the group that was randomized to the mindfulness classes. And you might be saying, well, this is a really small reduction. I mean, Andrew, we're only going from 8 headaches a month down to 5 a month. That's only a reduction of 3. That's really not a big difference at all. In fact, I don't really get why you're making a big deal about this, because actually when they followed these patients out to 1 year, when they followed them up 1 year later, there was at that point no difference in the amount of headaches they were having per month, which is likely because the individuals that were randomized to these classes stopped going to the classes after the trial was over. They stopped doing the mindfulness once the trial was over. However, I will remind you, the treatment that we have for headaches and migraines is some of the worst treatment that we have in medicine. We pass and prescribe drugs all the time that reduce your monthly headache burden by 1 or 2, or sometimes it's a reduction of half of a headache a month. I mean, what does that even mean? What makes treating headaches so difficult is the mental aspect which is why placebo does so well in most trials. Because mentally, you're taking a drug and you think my headache is getting better, and magically, the headache gets better. Headaches really are, most of the time, not all the time, most of the time, somewhat or somehow related to some sort of mental component or mental aspect. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not going to get further into the weeds here, but they are related somehow. And if you do not believe me, well, let me take you back. Let me take you back. Family Practice 2010, a paper titled Lack of Benefit for Prophylactic Drugs of Tension-Type Headaches in Adults, a Systematic Review. In this systematic review, which looked at prophylactic treatment of tension headaches, they looked at antidepressants. They looked at muscle relaxants. They looked at benzodiazepines. They looked at vasodilators. And they found there was no evidence, or really, really poor quality evidence, that any of these prophylactic agents are effective for tension-type headaches. So keep in mind, while a mindfulness course might not sound like a good idea to treat headaches, it might be the best thing we have, with a reduction of 3 headaches per month. And while this podcast might torture your eardrums, and there might be times you want to say, well, you should turn this off, I don't want to listen to him anymore, this next and last article falls under the torture your patient title. It is titled Cytosponge Factor 3 versus Usual Care to Identify Barrett's Esophagus in a Primary Care Setting, a Multicenter Pragmatic Randomized Controlled Trial. This was in The Lancet 2020. This was a non-blinded trial that looked to see if swallowing a special sponge to sample the esophageal and epithelial cells for biomarker testing identified patients with Barrett's esophagus in the primary care setting. Basically, it is impossible to diagnose Barrett's esophagus in the outpatient primary care setting. But in this study, the authors enrolled patients at least 50 years old who had received H2 receptor antagonists or proton pump inhibitors for at least 6 months in the previous year. The researchers randomized the patients to receive either usual care, which was just continued acid suppression plus maybe plus or minus an EGD if the provider actually felt that it was necessary, or they would undergo this torture office-based screening. In total, around 1,500 patients underwent this torture procedure. And before I tell you what the torture procedure was, I will say that about 90% of the patients felt that this procedure was totally tolerable and really not that big of a deal at all. But while getting a Foley catheter is technically tolerable, I don't want one. Not on me. Not at all. And while getting a rectal tube placed is tolerable, no. Not for me. I don't want one. So, what was this torture mechanism, this torture procedure that I'm talking about? Here you go. In the intervention group, it consisted of swallowing a capsule containing a sponge attached to a thread. And after the patient swallowed the capsule, then the nurse yanked the thread and pulled the pill out of the patient's stomach. Then they took that pill or sponge that the patient had swallowed and then pulled back out of their stomach and sent that off to the lab for further evaluation. You swallowed a pill and then the nurse pulled the pill back out of your stomach with a string that was attached to it. So you're swallowing a pill with a string attached to it, and then the nurse is ripping it back up out of your stomach and sending it off to the lab. This is a pill on a string. Oof. The results did show that those individuals who were randomized to the string torture procedure were diagnosed more often, twice as often actually, than the usual care group with Barrett's esophagus. The usual care group was diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus around 1%, and the tampon string pull pill group was diagnosed with a whopping 2% of the time. Yes, twice as often, 1% to 2%. You were twice as likely, and that's how this trial is probably going to get sold. But it's still a small number. And the thing that we have to ask ourselves is, what's the outcome we're looking here for? Sure, Barrett's esophagus, that's something that we're looking for, and I guess that's a reasonable outcome, but not really, because I don't have a lot of patients that care about Barrett's esophagus. They certainly care about cancer, but they don't care about Barrett's esophagus, because Barrett's esophagus is not cancer. We care about AFib because we care about the stroke that AFib gives us, not that we actually care about the AFib. Well, Barrett's esophagus turning into cancer is rare. A cohort study titled Incidence of Adenocarcinoma Among Patients with Barrett's Esophagus in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2011 estimated an annual incidence of esophageal cancer to be low, to be really, really low. They say, and I quote, Barrett's esophagus is a strong risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma. I couldn't agree more. But the absolute annual risk of 0.12%, yes, a tenth of a percent, is much lower than the assumed risk of 0.5%, which is the basis for current surveillance guidelines. Data from the current study call into question the rationale for ongoing surveillance in patients who have Barrett's esophagus without dysplasia. This is basically saying, listen, Barrett's esophagus, while it is a risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma, the actual risk is really, really small, a tenth of a percent, 0.12% per year. It is minimal, minuscule, mini. So I don't think that we should necessarily care. We should take this with a grain of salt, and we shouldn't be torturing our patients with a pill on a string. I mean, that is just awful in my mind. With that being said, let's wrap this thing up, cover the articles that we've discussed so far before this ship sets sail in a sea of evidence. The American Diabetes Association Standards of Medical Care Diabetes Clinical Practice Guideline, they say metformin first line. Then what kind of risk factors does the patient have? If they have heart failure or chronic kidney disease, then you should consider using an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 agonist. And that goes no matter what their blood sugar is. The reason being because of papers like this in the New England Journal of Medicine that show empagliflozin in individuals with heart failure reduces hospitalizations because of heart failure. Now, these drugs are still really expensive, and hopefully someday in the future, the SGLT2 inhibitors will take the throne as the top dog for diabetes care. I just don't think that'll be until they're much cheaper than they currently are. There were new guidelines out by the VA on the management of hypertension. They basically said that you should use an automated blood pressure cuff in your office. They also said the goal blood pressure is less than 130 unless you are 60 years of age or older, then it's less than 150. And if you are 60 years of age and older and you have diabetes, then it's less than 140. So 130 is normal. If you're 60 years old, then it's 150. And if you're 60 years old with diabetes, then less than 140. The treatment for headaches is terrible. The treatment for migraines is terrible, but it is something to keep in mind to prescribe mindfulness. There is something magical about mindfulness that took the reduction of headaches from 8 a month down to 5 a month, which really beats almost any pill that we have. And I think the downside of this is really minimal, maybe just a little bit of extra time in your life, but you're not going to get the side effects of a pill. You're not going to get the cost of a pill. There's no prior authorizations that you're going to have to deal with. So I think that this is awesome, and this is something that we should be using more often. And last but not least, there is a paper that took a pill, put it inside of a stomach of a patient, and then pulled the pill back out. That is magic. That is Houdini. That is a crazy way to diagnose Barrett's esophagus. And this would be really interesting and really cool if Barrett's esophagus was a big deal. But it turns out only about a tenth of a percent of the time per year does Barrett's esophagus go on to adenocarcinoma. And since my patients don't really care about a laboratory finding that doesn't lead them to cancer, they don't care about a laboratory finding that doesn't change their overall life and death morbidity and mortality. I think that realistically, with Barrett's esophagus, you're going to tell them to eat better and quit smoking. You should probably do that anyways, and we don't need to be doing these torture pill tampon string devices. And with that, let's end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.